And hello to the old listeners, the new listeners. Welcome to Dialogue Conspiracy. It's been 2 years, it's going on the third year of Dialogue Conspiracy for those who haven't followed it every week. The first program we had was a news report, an hour news report about the Pentagon Papers that broke into history, American history, just in May 2 years ago. And Daniel Ellsberg is on the peninsula right now speaking at Asilomar. He's in Monterey Peninsula. I was hoping to be able to see him, but I guess I won't this trip. I was, at the time those papers broke, talking about the relationship, the shock of the Pentagon Papers to the future exposure of the political assassinations in the United States, and making the connections of the historical importance of those papers coming out, and then the future information that people would receive on this political assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. Those stories are yet to break, but they're coming more in the news all the time. If you read the Pentagon Papers, which I did when I received that book, the first news story came out. I didn't have it when the broadcast came, just the first news accounts. But if you read the Pentagon Papers, there is a detail lacking in there. It is a section when it just first begins where a DM is killed, and the cables between Henry Cabot Lodge and the State Department. And that is in November, October 1963. And 1 month later, John Kennedy was killed. And the papers that were missing from the Pentagon Papers were the ones from the murder of DM, from the time that DM called Washington at 4:30 in the morning and talked to Henry Cabot Lodge and said, the place is under siege. And what should I do? And Lodge said, it's too early in the morning. I don't know what to do. He'd been planning this coup d'etat for 2 months, very carefully detailed in the Pentagon Papers. But he said to DM, I don't know what to do, and I can't wake anybody up. And DM said, well, you have my phone number, don't you? And Lodge said, yes, I have your phone number. And that was in October. And 1 month later, the next Pentagon paper is November the 24th. And that is Lyndon Johnson, and John Kennedy is dead. And my reaction studying political assassinations and coup d'etats where heads of states were murdered were, where are the missing Pentagon Papers? And Paul Krasner, who publishes The Realist, saw Daniel Ellsberg in Los Angeles, or asked him or Anthony Russo, where are the missing Pentagon Papers that cover the period from the time Diem was murdered until John Kennedy was murdered? Well, the answer, they never had an answer for that, never went into it. But the answer was very interesting if you watched the news coverage of the Senate Watergate hearings. They were supposed to be deep-sixed, according to John Ehrlichman, but it was L. Patrick Gray, the acting head of the FBI, who had them in his home in Connecticut and was later to burn them with his Christmas bundle, adding a little irony to the whole thing. Everything was around Christmas. They freed Hoffman Christmas, the Mafia freed on Christmas, and the Pentagon Papers, the forged documents, were burned. So the original cables were taken out of the State Department so they could be forged to blame John Kennedy for the murder of DM. But at the time that I went on the air here at KLRB and talked about the Pentagon papers and the assassination of DM, I said the CIA had killed DM. But Tricky Dick was rewriting our history like a lot of other tyrants. They collect the actual history, rewrite it to serve their purposes, and that's what E. Howard Hunt was doing in the White House, was rewriting the history to make it appear that John Kennedy ordered the murder of DM. Even if they were never discovered and these papers came out later to darken the name of John Kennedy as being a political assassin, the facts remain that the CIA did order and plan the killing of DM, and a lot of our history is being rewritten now. I'm sure they got caught with one document. You can imagine how many more that they're caught with. Well, the Monterey Herald this week had a book review of Executive Action. That's a new book by Don Freed and Mark Lane. And it's the story of the killing of John Kennedy. It's written as a fiction. It's actually, most of it is very factual, done with serious research by Mark Lane in particular, who wrote that one of the first books on the Kennedy assassination, Rush to Judgment. But the important thing is that the review in the Monterey Herald by Kevin Howe said a year ago there wouldn't have been much stock in purporting a novel about the killing of John Kennedy, and mentioning the fact that the CIA and the FBI and Cuban refugees and attorneys and politicos and generals were involved was just too far-fetched. But now, A decade later, it seems that any questionable government policy, the article goes on to say, that works in secrecy could be revealed, that the government could possibly have been responsible, that a novel that came out a year ago that said such things happened wouldn't have been accepted, but today it's perfectly acceptable that these high people in government, generals and lawyers, could be involved in the assassination of Kennedy. I just finished my second article for The Realist, which is should be out and distributed in another week or two, and I mentioned many lawyers that were involved in the Watergate conspiracy. And I was a very conservative number. I had a number of 125 lawyers, and I thought, well, that would really put a lot of lawyers on the defensive. They'd say, well, we were merely defending those that have been called in and died or suspected, that there can't be that many lawyers involved. But the American Bar Association is meeting in Washington, D.C. right now, and they have several things on the agenda, and one of them is to disbar all the lawyers that are associated with the Watergate affair. And they mentioned on the news this morning there were 125. I should have gone ahead and printed that figure. I know how many there are, and I listed quite a few in the article. But there's 125 lawyers that are suspected of malpractice and may be disbarred from the American Bar Association. So the story of executive action it's available now in Dell paperback book, and I think it's a fairly good account. It's not a great book, but it's a good book because a lot of it is accurate. Most of it is pretty accurate, and I recommend it as for the people that are collecting books on the political assassinations or want to know a lot about the crossfire and Oswald the Patsy, who didn't actually fire a gun that day. James McCord testified before the Senate hearings and is leading the front now to stir up a little more trouble, thank goodness. This was a very dismal week in terms of progress, as far as I was concerned. It was one of the most depressing weeks because Colby was assigned the head of the CIA and Kelly had just been assigned the head of the FBI. And if there were ever two appointments that showed that Watergate, after 1 year, proved nothing, these were the most disappointing appointments the president could make. And the fact that the Senate handed them over to them, and also Mr. Schlesinger as head of the Defense Department, that was bad. But the Senate handed these appointments over to these men. Colby's name was mentioned at the Watergate hearings when Mr. Cushman was talking, when General Walters was talking. He is the master of that diabolical Phoenix program, and he has over 40,000, I imagine that's a conservative amount of political prisoners locked up and known for torture. And it'd be like having Goering or Himmler appointed. It's a terrible appointment. And Kelly, with his computerized data bank police department that's linked to Intertel, which is a Howard Hughes corporation that ties in the international police organizations, those are the two most diabolical appointments. And in the wake of Watergate, instead of making them tentative to all the evidences out, the Senate just said, okay, Nixon, we don't know if you're capable to be president of the United States, but you can run all our police agencies. And if that isn't a sick appraisal of the situation, either the man is a criminal himself and he shouldn't be making any appointments, or they shouldn't even be conducting the hearings. If there's any doubt in anybody's mind, I don't know what the hearings are about. If they want to find out if the president's a criminal who's going to be disbarred or maybe go to jail, why should he be the head of our investigative agencies? And I can't see any way to break the impasse if the senators are that stupid. So we have this terrible impasse with Mr. Kelly now, just handing it over to him in succession from Patrick Gray. And we have Clarence Colby. But the one thing that can save us is that there's enough people behind the lines now spilling the beans, so to speak. And I got word this morning that James McCord is going to have a newsletter. I thought mine would be the first conspiracy newsletter. We've been planning it for a year, and it's just coming out. But McCord's going to have one, too, and it'll be coming out regularly, I understand. But James McCord just let a little more leak out. He has a three-part article that they referred to just briefly in the Senate hearings, blaming the FBI agents. He said they didn't search his automobile and his home after he was arrested, and they would have found $18,000 and $100 bills, enough to break the evidence in the case. And he said the FBI agents were blocked from conducting a thorough investigation. And he urged Clarence Kelly to permit the senior investigators to tell their story of the probe. Well, that's an impossibility, because if the senior investigators tell, the higher-ups will be even more involved. So by James McCord putting Kelly on the spot, then Kelly can also be accused of a cover-up. which is a beautiful way of forcing Kelly now to see, okay, you've been in 1 week, let's see what you're going to do. So James McCord comes out with an accusation that the lower echelon wanted to investigate the Watergate, but the upper wouldn't let them. And he has a three-part article coming out for the Armed Forces Journal. He's still writing for them, which I think is far out. But he said the FBI was required to clear every important lead in the Watergate with the Justice Department. Well, that is understandable. Kleinitz is head of the Justice Department, and Mitchell, the former Attorney General, in on the planning of these criminal conspiracies. You imagine how tight that is in Patrick Gray, the assistant under Mitchell in the Justice Department. Everything had to be cleared with the Justice Department. And McCord said many leads were killed that would have otherwise been found. And FBI officials were told to turn down all these leads, and no search warrants were put out for the men. And McCord said as late as 4 weeks after the arrest at his home, he had electronic eavesdropping equipment that was used in the Watergate surveillance. He had electric typewriter belonging to Howard Hunt. Now, if the FBI were actually doing a good investigation, we'd find what else they forged if we just saved that typewriter. But that's deep sixth already. He said, in my residence, they would have found additional electronic equipment and $18,000 in $100 bills and money used for lawyers and private copies of wiretap logs. And he said that he had memos from January and February of 1972 that mentioned not only John Mitchell's name, but John Dean, Jeb Magruder, and had to do with those 1972 meetings. McCord said, all of this documentary material I destroyed during the July 1972 period. The equipment I buried or disposed of in the Potomac River. You can imagine what's under that river by now. Half of their files that aren't deep, they're deep six, they're under the river. He said there were leads that led to Mitchell, Magruder, Dean, electronic equipment, and the Internal Security Division. Now that word is important. He said it had to do with the White House and E. Howard Hunt. The Internal Security Division is important for people that have read the article that I did and know about the Lewis Tacwood allegations, because the tapes he had at the hotel, at the Watergate Hotel in the Democratic offices, and the work that he did with Robert Marion, I'm convinced was the material they were planning in the Democratic headquarters to blame the Democratic Party for future violence down in Miami and the eventual assassination of Richard Nixon between the nomination and the election. And all of this was destroyed. There's only one person now that I know of who has the actual records of this, and that's Lewis Tacwood, who would know about those plans, and he has those in vaults outside the country for safekeeping until the Senate committee should desire to have him testify before that committee. But they're afraid to call him. Now, McCord said they didn't use any leads, and we heard Patrick Gray get up before the Senate committee and tell you about the magnificent investigation, the best since the John Kennedy assassination, the most thorough, complete investigation. I know that they had 150 men looking for Howard Hunt alone, and he was right there in the White House, you know, running in and out of the halls, and with Patrick Gray and everyone, I'm sure, in Washington knew where Howard Hunt was, but they were just too afraid to have him step forward until they knew what course to take, until everything was thrown away. But I listed 3 weeks after they were arrested a whole group of people that they could have called as witnesses, and I don't think the FBI probably saw one of those people. Because at the hotel, there were two guards that night. There were always two guards going around, and one went home, and he was supposed to be sick, and he wasn't replaced. Well, somebody knew that they were going to enter, evidently, who sent the guard home. The guard had to be in cahoots because he just walked off from his usual place, not fired or anything, but just went home. The men that were arrested, there were four more men that went down to Miami. They were never arrested. They were never named. They got some kind of I don't know what it was. They got off. They didn't provide much information, but they didn't get arrested, and they had their names. And Al Wong of the Secret Service was never called. And when he was called about 3 weeks ago for an affidavit, and five lawyers showed up with Al Wong to see about the affidavit. And Al Wong is the man in the White House who receives all those tapes from James McCord, from Butterfield. When he bugs the president's office, the tapes go right to Al Wong, and Wong hired McCord. See, the information that McCord had on the internal security is important because that was Robert Mardian's work to round up the radicals down in Miami. And This has all been destroyed, but he is giving out enough information to put the FBI very much on the defensive for the next 30 or 60 days. And he knows a lot more. So if they don't go into it, he'll keep talking. And if they go into it, then the conspiratorial part of the Watergate will get even heavier. So everybody has a piece of the action, and they're talking. There are a lot of people that they didn't call, and he knows it, and people that have followed the case know it. So Clarence Kelly is stuck now. He can turn into another Patrick Gray. He can either cover it up, and then McCord can throw out some new names. So they're all kind of blackmailed by the back there on who's going to tell the next thing first, and that's about the stage they're in. Patrick Gray said before the Senate hearings something interesting. They were giving him a hard grilling before his confirmation hearing, and they wanted to know what he had done to open up the Watergate case. And then one day he received a telephone call from Richard Nixon, and he accounted the story that Richard Nixon called him and said, "Hold on there, Pat, you're doing well, and hold on to yourself, you know, don't let them badger you," something to that effect. And then he said, "We have time later to get even with our enemies." Well, in this case, the enemy wasn't the Panthers or the Radicals or the other people they've been chasing around. The enemies were the actual senators who had a right to question Patrick Gray on his investigation of the Watergate. So Richard Nixon defines that as his enemy. It becomes perfectly clear where their heads are at, and no longer is it a game of chasing the hippies around. They are going to get everybody who embarrasses Pat Gray, because he was selected to be the head of the FBI, and the president is assuring them, "We have plenty of time to get even with them later." But then he spilled the beans, Patrick Gray, and admitted that he had lied many times and that he had burned all this material at home rather than embarrass the president. He knew it was politically a piece of dynamite, and he didn't come out and say, like John Mitchell, considering the alternatives, it was an election year, so I had to do it. But he said it was political, it was damaging politically, so he went ahead and destroyed the evidence and lost the appointment to be head of the FBI. I got a letter about 3 weeks ago that I didn't have time to answer, asking me about what's happened to Jim Garrison in New Orleans. And he's the district attorney down there that arrested Clay Shaw for the conspiracy, part of the conspiracy and assassination of John Kennedy back in 1967. And these trials have been lingering on and on. There was a $5 million lawsuit that Clay Shaw filed against Jim Garrison for damaging his personality and taking away his constitutional rights, that they were violated by naming him as part of that conspiracy down there. But he dropped that suit. After the Watergate, things got pretty heavy down there. Jim Garrison had a suit against him of planted evidence, and he also had income tax returns. Now, considering how they handle their enemies, all these income tax problems are interesting. I heard last evening that the White House had like 1,600 investigations of income tax problems on their political enemies. But Jim Garrison was faced with an income tax suit. He was indicted for not filing properly in 65 to 67. He failed to report more than $60,000 on his income. They came up with that. That he's fighting that suit. But in the meantime, with the Watergate breaking, just this last May, a couple of months ago, Clay Shaw dropped his suit all of a sudden. He didn't want to go to trial. And I think he was afraid that Garrison would bring up the whole thing again, because if the Watergate is believable, if it makes a conspiracy story believable in Monterey, California, to a book reviewer, that maybe the John Kennedy was a conspiracy, that assassination, then New Orleans may take a double look, and I'm sure they are, at what Jim Garrison alleged with the higher White House, CIA, FBI, and the Cuban community there. So they don't want to open up the case. And again, there's the other trial that was going on. Clay Shaw dropped his trial against Jim Garrison. That's been temporarily postponed, and I assure you that'll be shelved. But there's another trial going on, this bribery case against Jim Garrison, and that's the one where Pershing Gervais planted evidence against Jim. And now Jim has demanded all the wiretapping and the bugging against him. There are a lot of tapes in question, and the government informer, Pershing Gervais, has said that he planted these. You know, he's the man that I wrote about in The Realist, was given a alias by the Justice Department and $18,000 through the conduit of General Motors to plant evidence against Jim Garrison. So Jim Garrison's lawyer has asked, and similar to the Ellsberg case, that there was misconduct on the part of the government, and he's asked for all those missing wiretaps And the government came back and said, well, the wiretaps are too hazy, that something's happened to them, that you can't really verify the voices anymore. They've gotten fuzzy. But that case is held up now because of the wiretaps, and I'm sure with the Watergate thing going, that case may be dropped. I take the New Orleans paper every day, and the last article I got was that the judge down there said he didn't want another Watergate. So that's at a stalemate, too, because the government won't produce the wiretaps and the planet evidence against Jim Garrison. So those two cases are just stalemated, and to interpret that, Jim's holding his own. Now, there's an election coming up in New Orleans just very shortly, and he's running for district attorney again. He won by an overwhelming majority the last time around, in spite of the national harassment. And there are a lot of good people running against him this time, but I think the Watergate might vindicate him enough, and people realize that he just may win the election again. So we'll know in a few weeks. But that's the answer to Jim Garrison. He's holding his own. He's waiting for the wiretaps where he was bugged. He was, you know, on the enemy list with the income tax thing, and Shaw has dropped his case. And speaking of income taxes, another fine person went to jail for income tax returns. We have to start a file now of these because there was a systematic pattern before, but after the White House team of Dean and all of them have revealed the practice and shown the memos of how they get the enemy, the written memos, you have to take another look. And the U.S. District Court here, this week, sent the attorney for Juan Corona to prison for Mr. Richard Hawk for 6 months, for a 6 month sentence and $3,000 fine on an income tax return for 1968 to 69. It's so sad, it's really pathetic. And at the time that Juan Corona was convicted of killing 25 people, there wasn't any evidence that he killed one person. And you remember the jury went out and found him not guilty. And the judge said, that's not good enough, go back and come with another verdict. And they just about forced this poor woman, harassed her to the point where she came to a guilty, and Juan Corona family man who said he didn't kill any of those people was found guilty. The decision was changed, and she went along with the other members of the group, and he is in jail. It's unfortunate because these families just don't have enough money for retrials. And Richard Hawks did a good job of trying to show that he was innocent, and that defined you as an enemy of the state. You're not supposed to take these indigent farmers or the blacks or Chicanos, and you're supposed to just mind your own business. And when you do a good case and you work and you stay with it, your reward is that you get your income tax investigated. So if you're going to work for people who are not on the favored list, you better keep your taxes straight. I'll tell you, I sure do. I buy a lot of books, and they're tax deductible if they're for my research, but I never slip one in, not one paperback, not a 95-cent paperback or one postage stamp or anything. I stick right to it, and they'd have a hard time proving because I know that they would love to get into my taxes or tax records, so I try to keep everything just as straight as I can because I've been on to their tricks for a long time. But as they're publicly exposed, watch how many people come down, really good people, so that this Mr. Hawks, Richard Hawks, has gone to jail for 6 months, and it's really a shame. Well, the confirmation hearings of Patrick Gray, I want to go in a little bit, because in Dialogue Conspiracy, the concentration of power in a police state is done by a lot of simultaneous conspiracies at one time. George Meany said this week that Richard Nixon really wanted was a Nazi fascism, a Gestapo, and they can see it now shaping up by all the evidence. Well, there's been this very deep-seated conspiracy between the intelligence agencies and the Pentagon versus the FBI, because Hoover was a old dog conservative who wasn't going away along with their ways, and the intelligence agencies were determined to take over the FBI from Hoover. He was getting old, and they were going to take over the Bureau. And the man they selected to do that job was Patrick Gray. And he was brought into the Justice Department in 1971. If you heard him in the hearings, incidentally, he said that he worked with busing in Mississippi, in Georgia, and in the South. In Mississippi and Georgia, you know, after being in the Navy with the racist attitude of most Navy officers and far removed from any black problems or sympathetic to black problems, he sent to the South for the Justice Department to work out busing problems with the blacks and whites. That was in 1971, and then he went from there to working with the radicals and the demonstrators. When Richard Kleindienst came to him, now this is what he testified before the Senate committee, that came to him in 71 and said, how would you like to be head of the FBI someday? Now, J. Edgar Hoover was still alive, but this is 1971, and they're lining up the successor, the man who'd been in the National Security Council, who had never been in an FBI building. He didn't even know until he testified, I think, that there were burn bags under his chair. He used to take his own stuff home. He didn't know how many agencies there were. Patrick Gray didn't know anything about the FBI. He admitted it when he came in. And he was a perfect person to take over. They had total control of the FBI with Patrick Gray acting head. The evidence comes out in the Watergate hearings and everything he did before and up to that point. He had no investigative ability. He wasn't set up there. He was set to obey the orders from Mr. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Richard Nixon, or Agnew, whoever came along after that. So Patrick Gray is sitting there with the acceptance to the FBI, but Hoover's still alive. Now, the Interagency Group on Domestic Intelligence, I've never have on a radio program gone down some of the points of that disclosure, and I thought I would do that for this reason. It's so evident in all of this that J. Edgar Hoover, of all the suggestions, turned down every single one of them, and the acting head of this group was supposed to be the head of the FBI, the head of the Interagency Intelligence Organization would be the head of the FBI, yet J. Edgar Hoover didn't approve of it. Now, in August 1970, the plans were formed for that interagency group that we're hearing so much about on the Senate Watergate coverage. They talk about in July 23rd, Richard Nixon approved of the group, and I'll read all the different things that he approved of that they were to do. And July 28th, he, in quotes, rescinded the plans because J. Edgar Hoover didn't approve. December of 1970, July, that's 4 months later, Judge Sharp from Seattle was invited to Washington to participate to become head of the group that was rescinded in July. And he stayed there until January of 71, visiting the White House, going over the material. Judge Sharp was invited to head a group that was rescinded. Now, that's an interesting point. Mr. Houston, Tom Charles Houston, who did the paperwork for the group, has said that it never was formally rescinded. Now, the acting head of the FBI, Hoover didn't approve of this group, but they had a man who would go along with them perfectly well. And the day that Hoover was dead, the day that he was dead, Kleindienst called in Patrick Gray and asked him, now, would you be head of the FBI? He had asked him, it's interesting, Gray testified, he asked him in 71, would he be the head of the FBI? And Gray said yes, he would like that job. So with Hoover dead, Gray was ready to step right in and take over, and then he knew nothing about it. He just carried messages back and forth, and the agency then belonged to the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Council, for all practical purposes. Well, when Hoover died, for those of you who listened to the show a long time and know we talked about his death and his being taken away in that checkered car, I wish it were television so I could hold up to you the article that was in the Orange County, California. It was Wednesday evening, May the 3rd, the Santa Ana Register, and it's a picture of J. Edgar Hoover's body in back of a limousine. No hearse came for him. He died, and he was home alone, and he was carried away in this car. And all copies of this picture have been destroyed, incidentally. The newspaper copies have all been destroyed. And this had to do in the power struggle with Howard Hughes moving into Vegas, taking over the tables, taking away Mayhew and the FBI men. And the culmination of the struggle between the agencies was won over when Hoover was dead and then Patrick Gray took over. And it becomes quite evident in the Senate hearings that Hoover knew nothing about the FBI. He only obeyed orders. He did what he was told. Like if John Dean or John Ehrlichman come and say, take this home, he took it home. Destroy it. The witnesses that should have been called weren't called. He obeyed whatever they said. And his definition of a thorough investigation was to want a couple of men, Mr. Dahlberg or Mr. Ogerio, in Mexico. There were about 100 good witnesses in the United States he could have called without ever having to speak to these two men. But he makes everything hang on these two men as if that's what was holding up his investigation. That interagency group, the chairman, as I say, was going to be the director of the FBI, and the purpose was to effectuate community-wide coordination over the entire United States. And it would involve the State Department, the Treasury Department, the Justice Department, and other investigative law enforcement agencies. Now, that would go down to your local police force, because if you're following the Watergate, Mr. Laskowitz had access to all the New York City police files for anything that they needed on radicals, hippies, visiting dignitaries, foreign embassies. He could use the police files and give that information back to the Treasury Department or to Mr. Laskowitz and their particular agents. The Domestic Intelligence Plan had a White House liaison, that was Tom Charles Houston, who wrote these papers up and took them back and forth from the intelligence agencies to the president with messages for the president on how to accept this group. This is the one that included electronic surveillance and penetration. There were no holes barred. Anywhere they wanted, they could do it. Everyone knowledgeable, there was a notice on the paper, everyone knowledgeable in the field except Mr. Hoover concurred that the coverage was inadequate for domestic intelligence, that they were going after new left groups, and that the electronic surveillance should go ahead. As far as the mail coverage, the memo, the plan set restrictions on legal coverage would all be removed. They would relax their selected targets. And then there was a note, there's no valid argument against the use of legal mail covers except Mr. Hoover's concern about civil liberties. And they said it's very important to go ahead. Surreptitious entry, which means just going to any home any time, was passed by Richard Nixon. This was approved. There was a memo that Mr. Hoover didn't like it. It is the belief, I'm reading this, of all except Mr. Hoover, that the technique can still be successfully used on a selective basis. It is valuable to get information on subversives. There was another one about campus sources and filtering the campus demonstration. There's a note, Mr. Hoover is afraid that students will surface and be noticed as being FBI agents. And I read in quotes again, the intelligence community, with the exception of Mr. Hoover, feels strong that it is imperative to increase the number of campus sources this fall. Measures to improve domestic intelligence operations, that they would carry out what they called other objectives specified, but they don't list what those objectives are. But then there's a note, there's a problem here, since Mr. Hoover is fearful of any mechanism that would jeopardize his autonomy. We have to be careful of Mr. Hoover. Well, you can see there was another one on operational problems of who they would operate on. This is your enemy list, your targets. And there's a note, Mr. Hoover refused to go along with a single conclusion drawn or support a single recommendation made. Now, this is interesting because a friend of Mr. Hoover's just disclosed, Mr. Tully, a week ago, and we mentioned it before, memos from Hoover and remarks that he said to Richard Nixon, I feel that I have to stay around and protect you, that you're in danger. And you've heard Patrick Gray say that he felt Nixon was in imminent danger, that there was trouble around him. And yet, Hoover is dead, and Patrick Gray was sacrificed, and Nixon is circled with what you would call even his own enemy. They're around him this time. Well, the importance of this intelligence agency is that all these things were recommended to go through, and the only person blocking them was J. Edgar Hoover. So the minute he was out of the way, the next day, L. Patrick Gray became head of the FBI, and the following day he was supposed to investigate the assassination attempt of George Wallace. He didn't know, a month after the Wallace shooting, he didn't know anything about the agency. When the Watergate came down, he was being told what to do, what to investigate, and how to go about it. He wasn't an investigative person, and neither was Mr. Walters. If any of you watched Mr. Walters before the Senate Watergate hearings, he was Richard Nixon's man in the CIA. He referred to him as, how does he think he got where he did? He's been with him all these years as an interpreter. At the time that the Watergate thing came down, Mr. Walters, they were getting ready for the election. They didn't expect to be caught at the Watergate Hotel. They were getting ready for the martial law plan and their Miami convention strategy. But Walters was a plant in the CIA that they can manipulate totally. He was a political man that was accountable to Richard Nixon, but there was a cutoff between him and Helms, the behind-the-scene team, Cushman and Helms, and these other people operating the interagency groups. So that Walters was merely sending messages back and forth. If they wanted to send a message, they sent Walters. And gray was used for the same purpose. Gray was used to cover conspiracies and not let them out of the bag, and he was a perfect person to do it. And I didn't feel very sorry for him when I saw him testifying about, and they kept repeating about hanging in the wind. I think the committee thinks if they say it enough and it's grisly enough, maybe he'll talk about those people, because he'll get angry and realize that he's been deceived, and maybe he'll give us a little more information. But he's not the kind. He's sticking behind all of them, because to reveal any one of their crimes in the White House is to involve your own part in the conspiracy. There's nobody clean enough to talk about anybody else, because Mr. Gray certainly didn't go into the Wallace shooting, and he was in the agency at the time, and he didn't investigate the Watergate. So he can't talk. He has to defend his team. He can differ with them on opinions. It was pointed out that there were 27 major differences between him and General Walters, which is quite a few for a few hours' testimony. Nicholas von Hoffman called the Senate the halls of perjury. These men are just throwing out so many lies, it would take 10 years to figure out if anybody ever told the truth one time. But the halls of perjury are throwing out a lot of information, but none of them are really telling much. It's their life insurance to hold back a lot, and they're just giving us a little tiny bit. I think it was interesting, there were several articles this week in Dialogue Conspiracy. I can get off the Watergate a minute, because there's so many political assassinations that I'm writing up in Murderville now, you know, up 200 or 300. And I think the Aristotle Onassis information about his son being killed is interesting, because just about 3 months before his son Alexandros was killed, Onassis let out the information that he had done research on the John Kennedy assassination, that Jackie had asked him immediately after Kennedy was killed to find out who killed John Kennedy. And shortly after that, he did extensive research and had it locked in a vault, and was sort of dangling this in open communication that he had this information. And just immediately afterwards, his son was killed in this automobile accident. And it seems the evidence now, that there's quite a bit of evidence, I've read 3 articles, that the plane was sabotaged. There was one theory that Onassis was ready to get on the plane, and the other was that they intended to get, the son was a pretty good flyer, and the plane had been damaged, but they wanted to hurt Onassis. So whether it was the guerrilla group in Greece that had warned Onassis that you're going to be sorry for the things you've done, or whether it is the same people that are hurting families, persons who are knowledgeable of the political assassinations, it's hard to distinguish at this point. There's such a consistent record of the right wing being the assassins and silencing out of terror and fear that it's hard to believe it isn't that group again. I read that Jackie Kennedy was moving to Paris. There was an article that came out about her children in the Secret Service Guard, who was shooting a gun off the top of his car one evening just recently. And that was very hushed up, and then I received another long article about it, and it was hushed up much too quickly. The man, his name is John List, he's 28 years old, and he's a Secret Service agent who's in charge of Carolyn Kennedy and John Kennedy. And he got gun happy in a way that was really dangerous, and the way I read the article, I interpreted it as a threat to the children, that he was warning them that how violent he could be, just like Liddy's shooting out the light bulbs and the stories about Liddy being gun happy. And I was trying to get information. There's so much hushed up right after these instances happen, and they're very cloudy. But I got a follow-up article that the children have been moved to Paris. They're not going to live in America anymore. They're going to go to school this year in Paris, that they don't feel safe, that the gun incident had something to do directly with a threat on their life, and they felt that this guard was threatening them or teasing the family with his power with a gun, and getting in this altercation. So supposedly they were at school in the United States this year, and I read that they're not going to be in the country anymore. They feel too insecure here with these kind of threats. So those children have been moved away, and again, that family is troubled with the possibility of death. Norman Mailer's making a big splash with every magazine article with the Marilyn Monroe story, and he intimates that the CIA killed Marilyn Monroe. He hasn't got the evidence. I'm surprised. He's got a book coming out called Marilyn, and it's going to sell for $19.95. And there's a lot of evidence available. The best book I have on Marilyn Monroe was written by a man by name Frank Capel of Army Intelligence. And He comes into the Warren Commission hearings. He worked with General Walker. He's a far right-wing publisher compelled on the East Coast. He had the information about Marilyn Monroe's death, and it was used to blackmail Bobby Kennedy. It was to keep him from talking. The one thing, there was a running feud always between Herbert Hoover and J. Edgar Hoover and Robert Kennedy in the Justice Department. Hoover couldn't stand Kennedy. They didn't talk to each other on the phone. The lines were not cut, and they hardly had any words with each other. But the assassination attempt of John Kennedy was a very complicated military crossfire. But there's one thing they had to be sure of before they killed John Kennedy, and that one thing was that the Attorney General would not investigate the case. They had to be sure that he would never go into the case. And in all of my diagrams of the political assassination and the chain of command through Dallas and Washington and the Justice Department, the very top person, believe it or not, at that diagram was Mr. Capel, Frank Capel, because he held the information on Robert Kennedy, his relationships with Marilyn Monroe, and there is evidence, and it could be proven, that she didn't take all of those pills, that she had injection, that her autopsy showed no barbiturates in her intestinal tract, and I think the direct purpose of murdering her was to eliminate Robert Kennedy from speaking up, blackmailing him on other evidence they had of him with Marilyn on many trips and meetings that they had with each other. And they could keep Kennedy from speaking up about his brother's death. They blackmailed him in many ways, but one of them was through this death of Marilyn Monroe. But the same way that the death of Mary Kopechne was, Mary Jo Kopechne was achieved to keep Ted Kennedy from running in 1972. In 1969, by all statistics and articles which I saved through all this period, I've been saving them on the political assassination since November 63, Ted Kennedy was the man who could beat Richard Nixon in 1972. And it's very interesting the lengths that Mr. Lasowitz and Caulfield and Howard Hunt and Charles Colson had at Chappaquiddick. The Senate committee isn't going into that, and yet what happened in 69 had a lot to do with 72, because the man that could have beat Richard Nixon was put out of the race because Mary Jo Kopechne was killed. There were articles this week in the Washington Post, they haven't come out to the West Coast, about an apartment that Anthony Lasowitz kept in New York City with red velvet walls and velvet carpets, and it was a place where he had young men hired that wooed the girls. Most of them worked for State Department and advertising agency. The four or five girls that were with Mary Kopechne up at Chappaquiddick, and he had young men date these particular girls and use this apartment. And he'd get pictures of them, you know, having intercourse and compromising positions. And then the girls were blackmailed for their jobs at the State Department in order to tell what happened at Chappaquiddick. Now, that's where your tax money is going, in case you're wondering. It goes through the chain of command, through the Mr. Nixon to his attorney Herbert Kalmbach, to Mr. Caulfield of the Treasury Department, to Anthony Lasowitz, who got $100,000 in 1969. Just in 69, the summer of 69, at Chappaquiddick, and who was at the island on Chappaquiddick. And nobody at the commission, the Senate hearings, has asked Lasowitz. He said he was at Chappaquiddick. He was giving out stories to the newspaper. And nobody said to Mr. Lasowitz, what hour did you get to the island? Because he might have been there before the car went over. About a week after the accident at Chappaquiddick, and I read an article in Time magazine about the accident, we were camping down at Big Sur that summer. I called Mrs. Kopechne, the mother of Mary Jo, and I said, you find the Secret Service man that was in front of the cottage when your daughter was asleep in back of the car, and you will know who killed your daughter before the car went in the water. And that was in the summer of 69. And now we have a Mr. Lasowitz, hired by Richard Nixon's attorney, who's at that island, and the Senate committee has not asked them the question, what transportation did you get, and how did you get to that island at that time? And if they start to ask those questions, we'll begin to find out how Richard Nixon got the mandate in 1972. Well, the news is coming in really heavy. I always bring enough for 4 or 5 hours, and we've got 1 minute now. One little article away from assassinations. The Forest Service, according to the Office of Management Budget, has been ordered to cut down as many trees as they need and forget about the hikers, the hiking paths. We'll have 11.3 billion board feet more than they need without replanting new trees. Replanting the forest is out. The budget doesn't allow it. The Office of Management Budget, remember, is run by Roy Ash of Litton Industries, who gets billions of dollars of cost overrun on submarines. And write to your Senate, write to your committees, get Fred Malik and Roy Ash out of Office of Management Budget for 100 reasons, and one of them is to save the forest. Okay, our time is up, and I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy, featuring research specialist Mae Brussels.